What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to Fudge Muppet. This is the Elder Scrolls podcast. I'm Scott, here with Michael and Drew, as always. And today we are talking all about the great houses of Morrowind. So, where do we want to start? Let's pick one of the five, because we're going to sort of touch on the sixth house a little bit later, and we might have to do that in an individual video, because there's a lot of metaphysical cool stuff with that going on with Dagoth Ur. So which of the five would we start with?
A good like tiny little preface to put in there, I guess you could say, is that this kind of wasn't, you know, the Great House structure was kind of unique to Morrowind in that when, you know, the Khymer people, the Changed Ones, made their exodus across all the, you know, all the way from Somerset to Morrowind, they were following the good Daedra, Boethia, Azura, and Mephala. And, you know, largely because of Mephala's sphere of kind of like the web of intricate, you know, plots going on over here, all of this stuff like that. It kind of, they showed them how to structure their society in a much different way, which is what led to these five, six great houses.
Although if you think about it, it's not crazy different to another province in the sense of, you know, there's a bunch of factions and they all form together to have a kind of overarching council that rules things. And as we know, they're also very, easy to be corrupted like any other province's government
is. One thing too, we don't actually get like an exact formulation, because they obviously say like the good Daedra taught them the ways to structure things. But at the same time, the Khymer came across into what they call Rezdane, which is modern day Morrowind, and they had a period called like High Velothi culture, where they were basically, and that's when you see those like Daedric ruins and stuff in Morrowind, like these were the places that they had their establishments and so on. And then they would start, at one point they had sort of like a degradation of their society and so on, and then they ended up kind of, you know, whittling down into sort of like a Ashland estate, like a lot of the ancient Khymer around the time of Nerevar's rise and the Nordic conquests and stuff like that. They were living much closer to the Ashlanders, that by comparison to like modern Dunmer kind of things.
Yeah, like they're like more tribes that then became these big houses and civilizations with very distinct cultures from one another over time.
And like the houses too are, there are lots of houses. The great houses are simply just the houses that got the most power and influence and that are sort of the dominant ones. Like there are plenty, like, you know, like House Morrow or House
Sofa. Well, you even had the House Dwemer, you know, where they were kind of like extended that as a branch so that they could improve their relations with the underground dwellers who kind of preceded them.
Yeah. And we know that House Sadras, we don't know much about them at all, but we know that they're one of the great houses now.
Yeah, well, they replaced Hlaalu, who were obviously, they were very, you know, they were sympathetic to the imperial cosmopolitan ideals. And, you know, when things went kind of bad in the Fourth Era, their anti-imperial sentiment was high. That's, you know, ended up biting them in the arse and they got replaced.
Yeah, and you can imagine that, like, it's easy, like, everyone wants to pin their problems on someone. And I mean, House Hlaalu did cause a lot of problems, and, it's the perfect scapegoat, really, if you think about it.
Well, the big thing is, like, yeah, they just, instead of all of the houses, like, standing, you know, against the Imperial sort of thing, the Hlaalu were the most open to it, and they were taking constant advantages of working with the times, with the Imperials, rather than the rest who were like, you know, some of the more fundamental houses. Like Endora was so powerful that even when they did get whittled down a bit in the Third Era, they still remained, you know, had a lot of power. But House Dress particularly also lost a bunch of power, because a lot of House Dress's sort of traditional kind of rights and so on were, you know, helped being preserved by House Indoril. But when House, you know, basically, when the Empire came along and then they signed the armistice and they agreed to be part of the Empire, a whole bunch of House Indoril's highest officials offed themselves and committed suicide because, you know, it was shameful and they would never want to live under the Empire's thumb. And then, so therefore, House Dress kind of lost a bunch of their greatest supporters and so on because, you know, they were left with the Indorils that are a little bit more
I guess that's kind of interesting about Hlaalu is that you can kind of view them as being, you know, kind of a more basic house compared to some of the others. But really, they were pretty much the only ones with any real progressive values. And it obviously put them at odds with a lot, like especially with House Dress, because, you know, they have a financial reason. You know, they have all their plantations and slaves, and they have a good reason to not want to embrace any change. And then you've got House Hlaalu, who eventually... You know, you've got a Dunmer King who outlaws slavery, which is a pretty big deal. You know, that's going pretty far into the timeline. But
yeah, a lot of their plantations relied on that slavery. Obviously, you know, we can say it's a bad thing or whatever, but they're not economically viable anymore. So when and Hlaalu, they even gave kind of like not territory to the empire, but kind of, they were very hospitable. Like they just let them kind of like
The biggest thing.
Post up in there.
Like examples of like Balmoral was a House Redoran thing, and then it gets taken by Hlaalu, and they basically like Hlaalu was on these massive territory grabs and so on because they had the support of the empire, and they had like I'm pretty sure it's Hlaalu that dominates the ebony trade, and then there was like they were just able to massage themselves into this position where they were benefiting, and that's the biggest problem I think from the view of the other Dunmer houses, is that they look at Hlaalu like these sneaky little traitors, because Hlaalu, if they could, would have just kept all of the, you know, all of the slavery, all of their own values, everything they wanted. But they, you know, sneakily just used, they just basically like, it's a kind of like pretending to be like progressive and so on in that kind of sense. So they would just, they basically just didn't have any values. They were just flexible with whatever benefits them the most. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they. If you go and you look at the lore behind what they actually got, they actually used the empire to get favors and got awarded like all these rich ebony mines.
Yeah, well, not like, only that, like
things like this and fertile lands where they could grow.
I guess it might be important to just tell people that like, so they can probably understand Morrowind's structure. So. Let's talk about it all post Nerevar and so on, when there's the sort of great houses system and everything, and then bring them up to speed. So generally there were these great houses, and there's sort of a council, a big council that has members from all of the highest members of the great houses, and they come together and they sort of talk about things and so on. But then you also have the tribunal, which is above them, which are like, you know, the three tribunal gods. And they've obviously like, you know, they're a borderline, that they kind of are a theocracy really, like the, you know, the gods and the priests cast rule everything. But what happened is when they were basically forced into the armistice with the empire, Tiber Septim introduced an imperial monarchy, which is a separate sort of power in it's basically like a representative of imperial and Dunmer, like kind of alliance, I guess. So they started off, like one of the first examples is Baron Zaya, who was made like, you know, like the Queen of Mournhold kind of thing. And then she, you know, there was stuff going on there. Because basically he, if you look in Baron Zaya's story, Tiber Septim sort of pulled her away from destruction and then sort of groomed her into becoming this kind of... Queen for Mournhold. So you establish a sort of dynasty, and there were like examples of Duke, like Vadim Dren, who was a House Hlaalu member, and he became the Duke of Mournhold. And then you had like obviously Baron Zaya's child with Samarchus, who was a dark elf, but a general of Tiber Septim's army, married Baron Zaya, and they had a kid together, and that kid was Helseth, who was King Helseth of Morrowind. So they had this, so the Imperials were kind of like slowly trying to put out their like control it by creating a monarchy, and you know, Hlaalu was very accommodating. So this monarchy was basically made up of Hlaalu members, so you know, everyone else didn't like this. The power balance was slightly being, you know, fed towards Hlaalu over the last 400 years in the third era. So but then, yeah, so then that's a lot of the reason you have that animosity between the houses.
I mean, I'll give you a quote from like a kind of Hlaalu teaching that really sums them up well. Mm. Although in some ways you could say they destroyed their reputation and it didn't stick to what they wanted. But it says, "In the great wind of progress, tradition cannot stand. Grasp fortune by the forelocks. When you see your chances, seize them. When you see a chance to turn a profit, take it. but do not follow money blindly. There is value in reputation, more than many young Hualu realize. This value must be carefully balanced against the more tangible coins in any deal. Theft and murder are bad for business. You can steal from someone, but will he trade with you after that? You can't bargain with a dead man. So they seem very like pragmatic and basically like the ultimate sellouts, in the sense that like their main goal is just like being prosperous and making money and throwing tradition away because they believe it can't stand anyway, so they don't care about it.
Yeah.
But obviously they got a very bad reputation
by
the end of it. But, you know, they had their big reign with lots of power too.
So. That's things that, you know, they're about like, it's taking measured risks, but kind of like risks that go out of the norm that would be accepted. So, you know, when things do go bad, they're going to be the ones who get the spotlight, especially, you know, because at the end of the day, it's like, it's terrible timing because you have the tribunal disappear shortly before some major catastrophes, you know, an Oblivion crisis, and you've got Red Mountain erupting. So when that happens and you had all of the Imperials just completely pull out of your province and not aid you in your, you know, in your time of need, you know exactly who you're going to, punish for it.
It's interesting that they're actually I guess we can continue and we'll start talking about House Hualu because we've already sort of started on it. But one of the biggest hypocrisies of them is so they'll like have really close ties with the East Empire Trading Company, Imperial stuff, we know that. And then they've actually one of the only houses with like senior members being non-Dunmer. So they started introducing like, you know, they're opening their house to the more cosmopolitan values and so on. But at the same time, they've got really close connections with the Kamonatong, which are the most like xenophobic criminal organization in there. In fact, the leader of the Kamonatong in the time of Morrowind, the game, is the brother of Duke Vadim Dren, who is a, you know, high ranking Hualu member and Duke of Mournhold, and obviously all for imperialization. It's just fun to see that kind of like conflict and kind of like they don't have any, you know, obviously they'll be, that's on a greater scale, like not talking about each individual. Like obviously some individuals truly think it's good or bad or whatnot, but it just, you know what I mean, like people look outsiders looking in would be like, you're just the biggest hypocrites, like just doing whatever benefits
whatever you. Fills the coin purse basically.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know,
I think that's going to be a common problem theme where power resides, isn't it? We're going to see a lot of this.
Yeah But the problem as well with that is when you have that focus that's kind of, I don't know if I'd say anti-tradition, but just like, you know, less care for it, you do end up with just less morality in general. So it's like, well, this member of House Hualu will go behind the back of this one if it benefits them and they won't get caught. It just, I know other houses can be like that, but it just creates an environment kind of where that can happen
in a way
easily.
It's kind of, it's picking the winning side as well, because, you know, for a great part of history, you can imagine most of the Dunmer people would look at their demigod tribunal as just like, you know, they're unassailable. You can't go against them. They're you know, they're all powerful. And then you've got Tiber Septim come along and kind of, you know, like Tiber Septim doesn't conquer Morrowind, but kind of, you know, he also doesn't get completely sent away with his tail between his legs either. He really, you know, shows himself to have some strength and they kind of come to agreement. So it's like, you know, he's almost on par with them to an extent. And you can see why Hualu would be like, oh, could be very beneficial to kind of get in this guy's good books.
Yeah. And like, I do like also how, but if you think about them in the fourth era and where the Hualu continue to go, they're heaps sour. Like they, in Raven Rock, they try and like, you know, perform coups against House Redoran and so on. And they're still trying to like, you know, dig their hands in, because they're not a great house anymore on the big grand council thing, because House Sadras replaced them, but still they're around, like they exist in some capacity.
Well, they try to pull off an assassination, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, salty.
But yeah,
the salty house.
Hualu is, even if you think about them from the gameplay perspective, out of House Redoran and Tel'vani and Hualu, Hualu feels the sort of like thief assassin archetype anyway, and Redoran the warrior archetype, Tel'vani mage, like, so
yeah. Well, that's what I quite like about House Redoran, is that they're kind of just consistently no nonsense, and have, you know, they manage to, even when times are looking rough, they're, you know, things don't fall apart and they kind of come together and actually sort shit out, which is kind of refreshing. but Red Rain are good. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because even House Telvanni aren't really like that. You know, it is kind of unique to Redoran in the sense that they do care about each other.
Yeah, well, Telvanni is
like, Telvanni are very, like, you know, they work together, but it's very much like,
The most, like, pious houses, the most ones that benefited the most and enjoyed the theocracy there under the tribunal, it's definitely House Indoril and House Redoran. And I think House Redoran also, like, I guess we could start talking, which one, Indoril or Redoran first? Should we dive?
Let's go Redoran. I feel like Indoril is going to be a bigger one, so okay. Perhaps we'll get onto that one after.
So Redoran have, like, historically, they've had the sort of western border with Skyrim and all the land around there. And they've been kind of, like, treated as the sort of stalwart defenders of Morrowind, because they've just, and they're these seasoned warriors, they're constantly fighting off Nordic invasions and raids and stuff throughout their history, and they've kind of formed, like, I guess the backbone of the military and so on. And you'll even see them in, like, you can see the sort of, like, they took quite a liking to Vivek, in the way that Vivek had professed a lot of, like, chivalry and, like, sort of knightly values. And a lot of Redoran members actually make up a majority of the Buoyant Armagers, which is Vivek's personal own, like, knights, order of knights, essentially. And, yeah, a lot of them, you know, Redoran, along with Indoril, put a lot towards the Ghost Fence and sort of, like, the kind of like the Dunmer Greater Good. Like, you can tell, like, their whole, like, you know, you can look at their code, the things like, you know, duty, piety, and gravity, and, like, taking things very serious. You know, they're not, like, you know... jokesters.
It's a fairly consistent theme, I think, like, in the Elder Scrolls in general, that location and geography kind of impacts the race or the culture that develops there. And, you know, like, if you look around Mournhold, kind of central Morrowind, it's, you know, it's not the most hospitable place in Tamriel, but it's, you know, it's quite a nice area. And when you look at, like, Meereen's Dagon being a corner of the House of Troubles, who's, you know, he's the environmental problems, and House Redoran, for a lot of their area, as you said, kind of like they're constantly in conflict with the Nords in the Vlofi Mountains, but then they've just got really some very inhospitable, frozen sections that you wouldn't think about when it comes to Morrowind, but it's, you know, bordering Skyrim, so it's very harsh and cold there.
Yeah. And I love the line, a light, careless life is not worth living. Like, I do like them sort of, and you can imagine them looking down on things like Kla'lu. And to be honest, it's not like all of the houses get along entirely. Like, I'm sure they would look at a lot of the, you know, sort of luxury and stuff of House Indoril, and the riches and stuff of the temple, and sort of, you know, look down on it a bit because they're not, you know what I mean? It's, yeah. You know what I mean?
They're like a modest house, and they like to design things seriously but simply. You know, like, it's even reflected in their architecture style. It's, you know, built from local materials and kind of just, like, nothing too fancy.
Yeah, they've got some,
it's pragmatic, it's sensible, it's sturdy, it works, but they won't go beyond that to make it all crazy decorative and, like, over the top.
And I really like a bunch of their bone mold armor is really cool, and, like, the Redoran watchman helm and stuff like that. Like,
I mean, if you looked like that and had that armor and you can consider that sensible and not over the top, why would you want to go beyond it?
Yeah.
Do you really need to make it gold plated? It's pretty cool already.
Yeah, but, like, I don't know what else to because House for Redoran's the most easily understood one for sure.
Yeah, they're probably my favorite. If I had to pick a favorite, it would be them or Telvanni's really cool. Yeah. Sometimes you can forget how cool they are and take them for granted. But I don't know. I just like the... In a province that's filled with so much, like, backstabbing and questionable things, it's nice to have that consistent house who stays true to who they are. And they're kind of like the good guys.
I was just going to say, like, the mod Tamriel rebuilt, if, you know, if you've got Morrowind and you're interested in modding it, absolutely download that mod, because they do flesh out a large part of the west side of Morrowind. And if you look at Blacklight there, you know, capital city, it's so beautiful. It's like, if that's what it does look like in the lore, and, you know, if it's ever shown officially, I hope it looks something like that, because it looks amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're I do like Redoran a lot, but I feel like the other ones have more like zing factor, because it's very like, you know, they're all like very admirable values and so on, but they're pretty straightforward. A lot of their architecture and like aesthetics are cool, but also their symbol, their like crest is awesome. But yeah.
Would you want to move to Indoril now, or you want to like?
Yeah, I mean, Indoril's kind of
Telvanni in there.
Indoril's kind of important anyway, so we should kind of like talk about it. So, I mean, that all starts. So, House Indoril was like a thing before, like, you know, Nerevar marries into marrying Almalexia, so and becoming Indoril Nerevar, and obviously, like, you know, the Ordinators are almost, you know, synonymous, like basically all Indoril, and they have the visage of their greatest hero Indoril Nerevar on their face, and they are the most closely linked temple with closely linked house with the temple, the Tribunal Temple. And if you it's a funny, like, I pointed this out in the Ordinator video, but it's a funny irony when you kind of basically to what is the truth of the Tribunal, that they betrayed Nerevar and you know, stole power and so on. But because of the doctrine and story that they've spun, and they've even, like, you know, honored Nerevar and honor him through all of these, you know, tales and stories and motifs and stuff like that, that all of these Ordinators are walking around wearing Nerevar's face, protecting gods that betrayed Nerevar in the first place. You know what I mean? But obviously they don't know that. This is stuff that just gets carried on in Ashland and myth. And
they're predominantly very much the religious house.
Yeah.
Like, if you had to pick a religious house, this is it. And we were talking about before, and I guess we should just bring it up for everyone, this kind of idea that they're always involved with whatever the religion is.
Mm.
So when everyone's really just all focusing on the good Daedra, and you know, that's the main focus of society, they're all about that, right? But then obviously they come to revere the Tribunal.
Well, the Tribunal were very smart, weren't they? Because I think they, you know, everyone worshipped the good Daedra, but the Tribunal knew they couldn't just come in and replace them, which is kind of why you get the idea of the anticipations, right? It's because, you know, there's no Tribunal without the good Daedra. The good Daedra led to this, so this is just the natural next step. You know, so it really preys upon everybody's love for the good Daedra.
Well,
and this takes place over a very long time too.
So we're like, it's
not like they're like, you know, doing some kind of flip. It's more just like a slow adaptation into the next step.
Yeah, well, like for them, like, I don't think originally, like pre-Tribunal, that Indoril was necessarily the, like, hyper religious. Like, everyone was very like religious and all for the good Daedra thing, but everything happens as a natural progression. So, you know, once, you know, they're all into following Indoril Nerevar, obviously he becomes the center point of this new religion, and it's kind of like, you know, the Tribunal coming and becoming gods is like the coming of Christ. It's sort of like the, you know, like you've said before, Drew, it's like the New Testament to the Old Testament. You know, all of the good Daedra were positioned as the anticipations, these sort of like crueler ancestral forms of the Golden Age Tribunal that are to come, like more civilized gods that are going to bring them into a new age. And that's what really intertwines in Indoril with them. But if we just go all the way fast forward to the collapse of the Tribunal, and when they're decried as the false emperor, as a sort of bid to hold on to as much power as they kind of had, because the house had lost so much power with the Tribunal, they kind of really did become synonymous with the new temple, like of the faith. So now they don't, a lot of their, you know, they say to join the temple is to join Indoril, and that's what one of the priests say in Raven Rock. But it's like, I think it's like a bit of a natural, a coping mechanism to hold on to power.
Yeah, I was about to say that.
Because, you can see a lot of parallels to Christianity, because, you know, you have this idea that Nerevar, you know, the great houses can elect a Hortator to kind of lead them in times of need. And, you know, Nerevar steps into this position. He becomes, you know, Azura's like chosen one, basically. And, you know, when he sacrifices himself, even though, you know, he was kind of brutally murdered, you know, the Tribunal, even though they were responsible for it, they were kind of like Judas, they essentially became his disciples, and, like, you know, they were spreading that good word onwards, and then, you know, ascending as they did so, and it's hard to deny them at that point.
It's it's what makes really good world building when you can look at it and you can go like, there's a lot of like Hindu bits in there and trappings and stuff like that. But there is a lot of like Abrahamic sort of Judaism sort of stories and themes in there. Like if you read the 36 lessons of Vivek, like you basically have sort of like the Hortator, like so in Nerevar in the sense, and obviously any future Nerevarine kind of thing that's going to come and rise to that position, but is sort of like the Jesus kind of element, like the prophet. And then, and you've kind of got like the Sharma as like this devil figure, this Satan and so on this whole time. So you've kind of got this like, you know, biblical opposition and so on. And don't worry, you know, and you know, the Nerevarine prophecy, like, you know, he's going to come again, Hortador, and defeat the Sharma. And you know what I mean? And like, there's a lot of biblical sort of elements in there. And then you also like factor in that they have like a whole catalog's a funny word for it, but of saints, like catalog of saints, like, but there's all of these different saints that they have. Like there's a lot of, there's a weird mixture of things. It's like quite alien, but then there's all of the sort of, you know, traditional kind of European things to latch on to, like knightly orders and saints and stuff like that. And it's just a really cool mix. But, I guess we'll so Indoril was like super powerful, basically. Like they were the most dominant house for pretty much forever, right up until the armistice.
And that served a lot of other houses in terms of just like promoting Dunmer culture and Dunmer ways, especially against Hlalu's kind of like, you know, desire for more imperial culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And
as we said at the start, obviously Indoril is a big help to Dress.
Yeah.
And so with Indoril, you know, past its glory days, Dress is going to be in a lot of trouble as well.
Yeah. And so, like, and that's the other thing, like, you only talk about, like, I guess, because everyone, no matter what, I think, you can see, in, especially across all, like, fictional characters and everything, no matter the culture, really, you can kind of, everyone kind of gets this sense of there's an admirable, something to admire about them is that they sort of stick to their values or to their guns. It's kind of when you see the samurai like committing suicide, the seppuku stuff, and like that's kind of like a, not my flavor, I don't want to do that, but you can see how it's like a very honorable, like conviction is a very like, it's kind of like a beautiful thing. Like it can, I mean, it can be a destructive thing, but it's, so when you see in I really do like the story of like the higher up members of Indoril actually like sticking to their guns, and they're like, I'm not going to live in this, you know, they felt betrayed by the tribunal. I'm not going to live in this Morrowind under Tiber Septim. And then they all kill themselves. But I like how that, you know, had carry-on effects and changed the politics, because now you don't have all of these like hyper-conservative members of...
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's super bad for the house.
Mm.
Like, as much as... I mean, you could argue that the house is kind of, like, screwed anyway. Yeah. And that they're not going to... So, and they know that, which is why they choose to, you know, not stick around. But, yeah, the ones that left would be the weaker-willed ones. Or just a lot of them. Maybe not all of them. Maybe some were really, like, had strong convictions, but just knew that, like, you know... leaving is just not going to help.
You can see how this kind of becomes just a giant melting pot of problems that allows the Argonian invasion to be so successful up until they hit Redoran. You know, it's just so many things going wrong for them on so many fronts, and you know, their most powerful house kind of, you know, self-destructing when they lose their, you know, their gods.
Yeah, because even House Dress loses a lot of land and stuff because of that. If you actually like, because in the fourth era, we don't know as much. We can only get like hearsay from Raven Rock, stuff like that. But they seem to be like the dominant great house in the future, which is in
which house?
Redoran.
Yeah, because Dress are right on the front lines, aren't they? So you know, and they're not only that, but they're probably the biggest target for all the Argonian anger too.
Oh, absolutely, and the most convenient target because they're right down there. And I mean, that's why they were also successful when they were down there, because it was very convenient for them to go to the border of Blackmarsh to take Argonian slaves.
Yeah.
But you know, yeah, on the opposite end of that, you're first in line when the Argonians tear through Morrowind and start.
And they're bolstering
everyone.
Their numbers as they liberate each like plantation, you know, with a bunch of new slaves, just, you know, take a weapon.
I've said this plenty of times before, but I'm just like, how could they have not conquered all of Morrowind? Like, the things they had working for them. They had, there's this basically a volcano apocalypse. You've the loss of gods, completely weakened all around because of the Oblivion Crisis as well. And then it's kind of like they still get stopped by just House Redoran. I know House Redoran's like, you know, the backbone of the military and they're strong, but the fact that they couldn't get past the south is still, do you know what I mean? Like, Andrew.
Yeah, I was going to say, go look up my video, Are Argonians Weak, where I basically go through all of their military efforts throughout the timeline and kind of, you know, I mean, you all know I like Argonians, but they kind of do fail time
at the
and
end
time
of the
again.
Day, too, is like the virtue of like of a people or something is not necessarily always in their ability to conquer and conquest. So it's not like going,
oh, that makes them
bad. Yeah, it's like, oh, they're bad because they suck at conquesting Morrowind. But it's like, it's just that because of that one Daedra line that they seem to be like, everyone's like, oh, they're like the most powerful race and so on. And I really feel like it's just not the case.
Well, we have speculated before and it makes a lot of sense that they're just, the further they get from the heart of Black Marsh, the weaker they become and the less capable they are of adapting. And they, you know, they don't have connection to their overseers. And it doesn't surprise me that they would have been stopped, honestly. And I mean, even if you look at the kind of when you're getting into the north and you've got Vardenfell and you've got all the Telvanni controlled regions, I feel like that, you know, that they'd struggle a fair bit to deal with these houses.
What's fun?
I mean, it is sad for an Argonian that if you think about it, you finally liberate, you know, your brothers and sisters from slavery, but at the end of the day, you're kind of a slave to the Hist. Like, you just can't escape this label.
Yeah. The House Telvanni also got copped a bit because originally, before the DLCs came out, the only hint to Telvanni was if you go to, I think it's Branshay, you go do that quest for him in Riften, you get a book. You find a book for him and you find out that it reveals his past on this crashed ship, that he was like an escaped Telvanni thing. And it was sort of implying that the house was destroyed.
Was he on the Pride of Telvos?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was. But the book was that you go there to get it. You read it and it's basically giving you something along the lines of like, you know, one of the last like escaped House Telvanni things. But then obviously when you get to Raven Rock, you see Neloth there and it's like, no, Telvanni's like, you know, they're alive and well, but obviously smaller. But like, if you really think about it, like if you go through all of the modern houses, you've got okay, Halaosu Lalu's gone, replaced by Sadras, but that also, just by being a newcomer, I sort of assume they have a lower level of power. Dress has had their territory just walked all over, but then again, it's been like well over 150 years since Argonian in the Argonian invasion. Like, this is a long period of time for it to happen.
But isn't there some quote about them still patrolling around and stuff?
I'm not sure how far like that goes forward into the future, though. Like, I'm sure they're still like attacking, doing things at the bottom. I know that they assaulted Raven Rock at some point earlier in the history. You'll have to find it. But like but then you've also got House Indoril, which is basically withered and kind of just become the temple. So they've just, the Reclamation's temple is almost just House Indoril. So they don't really have the same power they used to. Telvanni obviously has shrunken and so on. So the only real big power there is Redoran left. Like, there is no one else to really compete with them. Like, maybe they're holding. Hey, look, it's evolution. Like, they've always focused on being hardy and sort of duty, honor, and you know, withered the storm. Weathered the storm, sorry. And all the other houses have fallen, except, well, you know, into, you know, weaker positions.
Yeah, well, they've had countless centuries of dealing with the Nords in the height of the mountains, and now they've got kind of like fairly disorganized Argonians roaming around. And I imagine that much of central and southern Morrowind is potentially even still contested ground. But I highly doubt the borders of Morrowind and Blackmarsh will change drastically because, you know, at some point, the strength will kind of they'll galvanize and kind of push back, and eventually I imagine that the Argonians will settle to kind of retreat to where it's swampy and where other armies really struggle to infiltrate. You know, I feel like that's inevitable.
I mean, Argonians aren't really like conquest based anyway. They've never been the type to like swarm into a new territory and build there. I mean, the whole modern Argonian philosophy anyway it's not supported to build architecture based out of Morrowind's environment.
Well, that,
like, if Argonians are like, oh, we're going to live in, you know, mud huts and reed houses, what do you, you know, like, it's just
their whole,
I feel like they're just there,
yeah,
for,
yeah, like, their whole core religious philosophy anyway is really like, live in the present, don't fear erasure in the future, and you know, and stuff like that. But that's why I think it's the Anzalil political party sort of gained power, and that sort of seemed like that was the kind of, like, you know, galvanization to get them to go up there and, like, get revenge and attack. Whereas I don't feel like that, because it's funny, because, like, they actually had just outlawed slavery, like, a couple of years prior.
Yeah, but that didn't actually stop at all.
What do you mean? No, of course it's not going to stop at all, but I'm just saying it's like I guess the worst time for revenge. It's like it finally did. Like, Helseth the rumors are from Oblivion that Helseth outlawed slavery. So slavery's outlawed the time of Oblivion. And then you've got, like, I think it's like 5 years. Because the Argonian invasion just happens after Red Mountain. It's about 5-6 years or something. So in about 5 or 6 years of, like, slavery being outlawed and peeled back, they just go on in.
Yeah, although I guess in a sense, whether or not they considered it, with Hlaalu kind of being kicked out of the great houses, that the abolition of slavery, I don't think, would last too long in a prospering Morrowind without Hlaalu. I feel like it wouldn't take long.
And I mean, they don't follow it anyway. Like, Telvanni's not going to follow it. Like, maybe Dress would. Telvanni would just be like, no.
To be honest, like, I'll do what I want. I have a feeling, like, I've got mixed things. Like, this is something that's weird. It's still a point of, like, I haven't seen any, like, strong evidence for either way, but, like, some people sort of treat Morrowind as if it's still part of the Empire, but I really don't think it is. Like, the whole DLC Dragonborn kind of gives you the impression that it's not. But in that sort of same way, like, they don't have a king or anymore, like, an imperialized sort of monarchy or anything. So I kind of, like, you know, Mournhold was just destroyed. So I'm sort of like, I don't really, I don't think they're being ruled by the Empire, and therefore I feel like they'll get back to some more traditional roots. And I feel like that's the way it's going, just with the reclamations and the resurgence of the good Daedra. Like, there would be, people would be looking back, like, they'll be looking back beyond the false gods and so on, and really getting, like, you know, and especially, you know, how, like, in times of crisis people really do tend towards religion more, because, you know, it helps them deal with it.
And traditionalist parties usually go well.
Sorry?
It's like, I said traditionalist parties tend to go well. It's kind of like, we need to return to our roots because that's what made us great in the first place.
Yeah, and as,
like, straying from that is what caused our
especially
downfall.
When you think, you know, that they were kind of founded on Boethius' teachings of kind of, like, overcoming the tests. You know, you've got the House of Troubles that are, like, the embodiments of tests they have to deal with, and they're being tested at the moment. So, it, you know, that's when they should theoretically thrive. Is in a time like now, is just to come back hard and, yeah, like, come back with the good Daedra, not with any progressive values, but exactly what the Daedra said thousands of years ago.
Yeah. But then...
So I was going to say, on the other side, we don't know just how weakened Morrowind is. Like, we're not aware of the full state of things. Like, how... Like, what does it look like? How ash-covered and just destroyed and, like, downtrodden
is
Morrowind?
See that Red Mountain is still fuming. So I can... You could kind of imagine that Vardenfell, at least, would sort of just be constantly having, like, those same ash storms that you experience in Morrowind the game, but, like, kind of all the time. Mm. But whereas, like, there's probably... Other areas are probably fine. Like, it's obviously not going to be the same as if it just blew up, because it's been... You know, nearly 200 years. Like, it's been like 194 or something years like that since it exploded. And also, the Argonian invasion happened soon after that. So, like, Morrowind has had, you know, over 100 years to recover. You know, even if all of the damage things really sort of, you know, carried on for, say, you know, right up until like year 80 of the fourth era or something, it's had all of this other time.
Look, here's the thing, that's true. And, like, that is a long time to heal.
Mm.
Like, if you go look at, like, you know, societies that get destroyed and annihilated, that is a long time to recover. But the way Skyrim's written makes it all feel so recent. Mm. And even, not besides just the refugee crisis in Windhelm and how, like, you reflect and you're like, wait, they've been here for, like, 100 years and they still kind of, you know, the Nords and the Dunmer haven't integrated. There's still, like, this big criminal, like, community, and, like, there's still heaps of tensions and problems. But then when you go to Solstheim, it just feels very recent. You know, like
I think
the Nords kind of gave them Solstheim.
The biggest, most beneficial retcon to Skyrim's storyline would be like setting it like, you know, 30 years after Oblivion instead of 200, because then you could just have all of these events sort of happen. They feel like more tangible, and you can see the ripple effects of these things without thinking that like, oh, it's been 200 years. It's like too long. Do you know what I mean?
That's
like,
kind of the thing with the Elder Scrolls timeline in general, is there are so many points in history, you know, much more egregious examples where you can see just hundreds, almost thousands of years pass with kind of nothing really going on and no major changes. It's almost like, you know, the way things advance and progress in this universe is just nothing like it is for us.
I think I said on Twitter or something, you could take like the nearly 3,000 years of the first era and condense it to about 1,400 years, and it would still have that sense of like pace. Like, I think it all comes from like a lot of like roots in fantasy. Is like Lord of the Rings has this massive timeline. It's huge, and it's thousands of years go by and characters live for all of these thousands of years. But if you want it to like to feel more like close to realism, is like things change really quick. Like, look at the last 100 years. It's kind of like how like you know, like the age of knights in full plate armor and gleaming and so on, like that kind of lasted for 100 years, and then guns came about, it was gone. So that was like 100 years of, you know, technology. But what I'm saying is, even if you apply this to a fantasy sort of mentality, you could like double the amount of time, triple the amount of time, and it's still such a shorter timeline by comparison to Elder Scrolls. Or
I think
It's just a cool little thing. I think you'd, you know.
I was going to say, in Elder Scrolls 6, one of the good things about leaving a timeline open is that they can write books just about historical things that you've never heard of and date them in that timeline where there's space. Like, I still agree that they definitely could condense it, right? Like, absolutely could condense it. But it is nice that there is space there, so you can pick up a book. And it's obviously not going to be something super world changing, otherwise you'd be like, why haven't I heard of this yet? But you can just read a book about some battle or some skirmish or some war between two kind of like not provinces, but like districts or like two small territories that each had leaders, you know, back in some certain time period fighting in whatever province, and it would be cool. And they can just leave those little gaps there.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But yeah, so let's get back on track with the houses.
I guess we'll go to House Dresden.
Yeah.
Like, to just kind of give them a bit of a focus before we move to Telvanni.
So, House Dresden, massive salt rice plantations. They're massive fans of slavery. They're staunch defenders of slavery because it's their main labor force. They basically capture Argonians, and because Argonians have like, you know, all different resistances, they're very adaptable. They use them in these massive, you know, salt rice fields, and also like you know use them in mines where potential like, you know, toxic noxious gases and stuff like are there that they can survive. Like,
they're not and it's not just a pragmatic thing or a financial thing. Like, they're also extremely xenophobic. So how stressed they consider the Dunmer to be above, you know, the other races.
I mean, we should
A lot of Dark Elves do, but they really...
Because we like, should throw you know, as a disclaimer.
Strongly like, believe that.
Dunmer are like one of the most xenophobic races, like period, across all of them. So it's like...
But of that, I just know like there's this quote from Understanding House Dress, and it's like the isolationist stance of House Dress was instilled in its customs and world outlook from the very beginning. Not only do we consider the other cultures and races to be inferior to the Dunmer, we deem any extended contact with them where we were not in total control to present a danger to Dunmer society. Ideas, like a plague, can spread without warning and prove to be impossible to contain. Instead, we should concentrate on inter-house relations and improving the position of the Dunmer to make our society stronger and eternal. So you can really feel that like traditional, like, I don't even want ideas from other races.
I would say that's probably the same, like just extrapolating, it's probably the same as House Indoril, for example, just based on, and you could even extend it to Redoran to a degree, just because like Indoril, like by virtue of being a theocracy, you're like, everything's dogmatic. Like, you've got these gods and these gods that can enforce it and so on. So it's all really, rigid, like no heresy, you know, like everything that's not.
Then why do you think House Stress would label themselves as that? Then they must have some kind stronger, or what is it, a competition? Like, I'm the most xenophobic.
Well, no, I think it's just like if you read it, it just reads like it's their philosophy, which just matches up with some of the other houses, like Indoril, for example. I think Redoran maybe a little less so, but even if you think about Redoran, like their dedication to clan, family, and duty and gravity and stuff like that seems like a much more, and you know, obviously they're more entrenched with the tribunal as well. I mean,
it's kind of a beautiful thing about the Dunmer is that they don't discriminate. That, you know, they'll enslave just about everyone. You know, it's like they mainly enslave Argonians because it's easy. Khajiit, perhaps the next easiest, and perhaps they put them at the bottom, but they'll enslave humans as well. You know, you can find them in slave pens, in Tel'vanni territory even? A lot. And
so enslaved high elves, I'm pretty sure even wood elves, like there's, yeah, just anything goes. Like, they really see themselves as, like, the only, like, you know, out of the elven races as well. Like, obviously, by the way, like, this is a generalization of, like, times of their society and so on. Like, there's always going to be individuals that are against or for because...
Yeah, like the Twin Lamps and all the other abolitionist
Even those kinds of abolitionist groups. Kind of groups, they would not have existed before the armistice, you know, before the Empire has any control. Like, looking beforehand, it's... I mean, I know ESO put them in this... And, like, this is where we get to the whole Ebon Heart Pact kind of stuff, where only a few of the houses join, but then it's kind of... I still, to this day, think that the Ebon Heart Pact is, like, poorly done just because...
You have to take the lore added. I don't just mean Elder Scrolls Online in general, but specifically Morrowind. I think you have to take it with a grain of salt, and perhaps even in Somerset, because realistically, say you've world built a very xenophobic race who don't they consider anyone who comes in outlanders and kind of give them side eyes and whatnot. You can't make that work for your game if you have an MMORPG. It's like it's not possible. So you kind of, you know, you take everything with suspending your disbelief a little bit, and I think. The Ebon Heart Pact is kind of an example of that.
It just annoys me because they could have had an MMO without doing that. That's such a massive... And I know it's only a few houses, but I just don't buy it that there'd these be long-standing, thousand-long-year theocracy, tribunal gods. They can defend themselves. No one can conquer them. The Riemann Empire couldn't even do it after trying for 80 years. It's just sort of like... Then all of a sudden, they're like, actually, we'll work with... Our greatest enemies and our slaves, you know what I mean? And like work with them. Like it just kind of sounds silly to me. And I know it's only Eastern Skyrim too, but I mean, Eastern Skyrim, if anything's the more like conservative side of Skyrim.
Yeah. Yeah. And the one they've had fights with and stuff.
Yeah. It just, and I know they go, oh, for the pack, there's all these reasons, but what I'm saying, they're all cope reasons. They're all, it's like all that happened was they could make sense with the Aldmeri Dominion. They could make sense with High Rock. To a degree, like even the way they wrote in the orcs into that kind of thing, it was like a real, I actually like how they did that because it was a very temporary thing just to get to that High King Emmerich was leveraging to get orcs to help him. So then he'd set them up with Orsinium and like, you know, it was a mutually beneficial kind of thing. And also that pact, you know, falls apart with the death of Kurog. But in the Ebon Heart Pact sort of scenario, it's just they're so ideologically opposed and they're basically just like, oh, we're going to mash the other three races together somehow, you know, and it's like unlikely alliance, but I'm like, yeah, it is very, very unlikely, like too unlikely.
Do you think they could have done it differently though? Do you think you could match? I mean, the whole system is flawed anyway, but if I just, you know, a little fun challenge, I'm going to force you to use their parameters and you have to make three alliances, you know, each one with different races. Mm. How would you do it that makes
sense? I mean,
sense?
I don't like the alliance that... I don't like the story like that anyway. Like, I just...
Me too. I'm saying if you had to use their parameters, you can see how they were forced into it.
Yeah, I think you could split them up differently. Like, why couldn't you do like a more...
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. Let's do it.
So, I mean, you could go...
Because the old Miri Dominion one makes a lot of sense. The old Mary Dominion.
But even the, to be honest though, but the Khajiit thing, like it's even going back, but like it doesn't necessarily make, like, you know, they did it because of the, where the Khajiit are in the Aldmeri Dominion in the future. But the Aldmeri Dominion Khajiit thing is very specific. Like, they made the moons disappear and they sort of rebuilt the kingdoms and took them on as client states kind of thing. But if you went back, like, you can get away with it. It's still not the most ideal. But I don't know if Khajiit and Argonians, because it just literally, the fact is, some are not meant to be in alliances in together.
Exactly. Well,
but that's I think that whole premise was, they just did it for PvP.
Yeah.
They wanted to.
The premise was a bit awkward
because, you know, it did force you as well. If you wanted to play with, I think if you wanted to play with certain friends, you had to be a specific race or a group of races in each pact or whatever, I think might be
originally.
But I mean, like, you know, one thing that could work, but at the same time, I'm not a game dev, but it's like, you know, you could potentially do, you know, High Rock, Skyrim and Cyrodiil versus Valenwood, Somerset and elsewhere, and then you have the other three races as kind of independent factions. I don't know, but then, you know, then I'm not sure exactly how that'd work, but I think the orcs being on their own,
I mean, yeah, you could have all kinds of.
Yeah,
you could. You could have all kinds of things. It's just, yeah, they wanted
the biggest, like, throw-in in the thing is that just in terms of, like, Morrowind's growth, like, by the time you get to the Armistice and so on, it's supposed to be like, you know, House Sindoril are all committing suicide after they would never do all of these kinds of things and interact with all these other races and have them have any degree of power. But by virtue of being in the Ebonheart Pact, the others are sort of, they're exerting a sort of power, a sort of cooperation over other houses. And, like, why weren't they offing themselves when they made that alliance with the Nords and so on? And, like, the same way, it just doesn't stack up. And it's like, the reason is also, it's like the why. Like, there's a very good reason why they signed the armistice. It's because Dagoth Ur had cut them off from the source, the heart of Lorcan, so their powers were waning. And they saw that, ooh, shit, we might not be able to beat the Empire, so let's actually make a favorable alliance now. And, you know, they saw that Tiber Septim was basically going to win, so they just played their cards right at the time. But there was a reason for that, you know. But when it came to Reman and they were sitting there fully powered, they were like, they kept on trying to knock him back. And you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think we could probably move to House Tel'vanni. Yeah. I'm kind of keen to talk about
them. Well, I guess, you know,
them.
One way to link the two topics is, I guess they at least kind of threw us a bone by having Tel'vanni be the one house who are like, they look at the Ebonheart Pact and like, nah, we're not interested, you know, much to the chagrin of the other houses. Mm. And that, you know, that is a good way to, in a sense, sum them up, that they wanted no part of that crap.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then, yeah, I just start feeling like the same way as Scott now, where I'm like, well, why would this other
house?
Like, they should also just, yeah, it's just silly. Anyway, House Tel'vanni, the House of Magic.
Mm.
Let's get back on track. They got the most powerful mages and the coolest mushroom towers, and they are very much isolationist, and they don't care about others. And they'll even kind of do bad things to one another, because of their whole belief system and their kind of motto.
Yeah, they're really like, it's a real dog-eat-dog world. It's like, if you stole it and got away with it, you deserve it. If you beat him, then obviously your argument has the better merit. Like, it really is sort of a, like, you deserve it if you get it, basically. If you were more cunning, or you were more, you know, intelligent and you had the better plan, or, you know, the more powerful magic. It's kind of a weird thing because it pits a lot of the house against one another, but they're kind of like, the House Tel'vanni is kind of like a, it feels, I guess, even more like the you know, we were saying, like, the Thieves Guild kind of feels like a union rather than like a tight, like, belief kind of thing. But they're all of these very isolationist, individualistic mages that sort of benefit preserving those protections by being a house. Well,
in a way, it's almost like a dragon-like mindset, in that, you know, being the most powerful and being right, you know, being the most powerful is being right. And, you know, in a sense, you can kind of look at it like, these are all very individualistic characters who care about their experiments and expanding their knowledge. And they can benefit from having someone who they may hate in their own house, who's also a genius. And they kind of, you know, they're all, if they're advancing their studies of magic and science or whatever, then, it's... I guess it's for the good of the race and the house and themselves.
Yeah, and I think you can't... Like, it's just more incentive to be isolationist. Like, if you are Tel'vanni and you follow the whole wisdom confers power and power confers right ideology, you go off to study, I almost wouldn't want to live around lots of other powerful Talvani. They might just kill me because they want to, or because, you know, they see me as a threat. Like, it's very, you know, there's not a lot of, not a lot to be gained by being super social.
Yeah.
In House Talvani.
It's worth noting that they're like the most, like sort of secular, like they kind of don't really care about the tribunal. Like, you won't find many religious sort of, people. Like, you know, they might be like base level, but you know what I mean? They're not like, you don't find zealots among the Talvani typically.
And they send their mouth to their meetings for them. They can't be bothered.
Yeah.
Like, they have, not their actual mouth. They have like a representative called the mouth.
Yeah. And that's cool. And they've got so many eccentric characters. Like, oh my God, I've completely, one of the first one is it's the woman with the naked Khajiit slave and all of the gems aligned. I've forgotten her name, but basically she's just this absolutely insane, Dunmer woman, powerful mage. And then there's also Dyveith Fear, of course, that he's cloned himself for like wife, daughters. And he's got like a dungeon, which he tries to encourage thieves to go and steal from. But they can't, you know, they'll probably get killed. Like, he's just got a bunch of different things going on. Yeah. And Dyveith Fear is just really cool as a long-standing character. There's plenty of ancient wizards here, like, you know, because, you know, he's the oldest, supposedly, which is like over 4,000 years old at the time of Morrowind. So he was around even when they were Khaimah. Like, he would have witnessed, like, physically witnessed being Khaimah turned into a Dunmer and, like, experiencing that. That would be crazy. But I'm sure there are plenty of examples of, like, oh, he's a 1,000-year-old wizard. Oh, he's a 2,000-year-old one, you know?
No, they are cool.
That's one thing. It's like, you know, you imagine their counselors meeting that they would barely be able to agree with each other on anything. So it's almost pointless them getting involved in the politics of the other great houses, because they're never going to see eye to eye with anyone pretty much outside of their own tower.
They would be incredibly unlikable. Like, you love them in the games because that's how, like, games and movies can feel like that, where unlikable, like, as in if you lived in the world, they'd be unlikable characters, are really cool.
Yeah.
But, like, if you actually had to meet and interact with them, yeah. Like, Nelloth, for example, you'd be like, ugh, gross. Like, using his own apprentices for bad experiments and, like, you know, I'll teach you magic, and then, like, doing dodgy stuff to him. It's cool for a game.
Yeah, well, you can imagine, you know, some of the other houses kind of suffer them, because it's like, if we really need them and we can actually get them to help us out with something, you know, like, they lend their wisdom or their power, you know, for example, stopping an enemy, and they actually bother to help, then it's like, you know, you've got this really powerful wild card, except, you know, it's like you don't have the right gym badge, so they don't obey you. It's just you hope that they do the right thing to win you.
It's kind of like a reluctant, like, court wizard that you just keep in the back pocket just in case you need him.
Man, I really do like how, like, I think Morrowind really did, like, the politics and stuff really well, because there's so many, like, cross-sections. So, you know how Talvani, you know, they're all the isolationist kind of things, but they're very staunch defenders of slavery, which sort of makes them naturally more so allies to House Dress. And House Dress is, you know, their biggest offenders of slavery, and they do... and they, you know, all of their sort of agriculture and stuff. But then you've got that sort of cross section where Dress are very, very traditionalist, which crosses with sort of Indoril, which are very conservative and orthodox. And then you've got that which crosses with House Redoran, who are like quite, you know, pious family sort of stuff. And that crosses with Indoril. And there's a lot of like, just, you know, interconnectedness. You know what I mean? Like,
it's hard not to fall in love with the Dunmer and Morrowind above pretty much any other race in Tamriel, because it almost seems like the amount of complexity of the relationships between the provinces is pretty much on par with the complexity of just the powers and politics in Morrowind itself. You know, it's so detailed in so many ways that
I mean, that's one of the best things about them, is that not only are they, you know, when you die, so there's some races that might look more plain, but then you dive into them and you're like, wow, there's actually a lot more here than I thought, and they're really cool. Dark Elves and Morrowind in general kind of just win on all fronts, because it's like, not only is there a lot of complexity behind the scenes and in all the world building, but they're also just really aesthetic and like cosmetically cool as well. Like, you know, we use magic to build mushroom towers, and the only way you can get up is with levitation, or, you know, this cheap press A in the DLC and just fly up there using whatever magical assistance that it has.
If you think about it too, a lot of the problem with a lot of other places is by comparison where they're just going to lose is they're either generally either a binary or just a like a monopoly essentially. So like, you know, Somerset Isles completely under the control, the Aldmeri Dominion. Valenwood is kind of feels the same, even like if it's not under the Aldmeri Dominion, there's just lots of tribes and stuff. Maybe that would be cool. But like, you know, if you were elsewhere got like cut into two kingdoms where you've sort of got north versus south. In Morrowind, you've got, in Skyrim, you've got like east versus west or Stormcloak versus Empire, whatever, but basically conservative versus progressive. Exact same thing with Hammerfell. You've got crowns and forebears. It's just sort of the one or two. Whereas in Morrowind, you've immediately got five different things all vying for power, and then within them they've got their own conflicts, and then you've got the temple as well, and then obviously because of the setting you have the Empire's interests all stuff coming in as well, and it's just this big intermixture of stuff. So,
and the sixth house,
yeah, exactly,
all kinds of stuff. Yeah,
well, I guess let's we can touch on the sixth house a bit, which is more or less, like, originally House Dagoth was back when Dagoth was around with Nerevar and stuff at the time. Like, he was just another house of the Khmer house. But obviously, as he was either killed because he was a baddie or betrayed, or there's all the variations of Battle at Red Mountain, but basically he became sort of like the Sharmat Dagoth, the false dreamer. But basically the sixth house from that point onwards sort of became a cult dedicated, the way that you could frame it, you know how we were using the biblical thing before, comparison, you can kind of treat it as like if the Sharmat is there like Satan, you can imagine like the Satanist cults. That's kind of what the sixth house is to the Dunma people. It's like, do you know what I mean? That's the kind of vibe, like all pentagrams and stuff like that. Like that's the kind of vibes it gives them. And that's kind of what they are. Like obviously when Dagoth is sort of returning in more so full power during the time of the third era, the sixth house is expanding a lot, and they're smuggling like these sort of like ash statues and stuff to and getting into people's dreams and spreading his basically like his blight and his influence and stuff like that. But to be honest, they are kind of the baddie devil Satan cult house, but they weren't originally. It's just because their leader is the Sharmat.
I like they have supposedly have this affinity for music and sound as well. Like they have all these bells and chimes and stuff at their shrines, which they use in rituals. And
because it's
pretty sure there's even a creature.
Well, what it is when you go into Elder Scrolls. So the you know how the Elder Scrolls has music and stuff and visualizing on, and you know there's a tonal.
Yeah, like everything's a song.
Yeah, and the tonal architecture and the Thorm and all of these things are sort of like musical oriented. So it's sort of talking about the fabric of universe as musical. You'll see the earliest sort of ash zombie minions. They're like eye caves in kind of thing. And then it caves in more, and now you start getting like a tentacly-looking sort of thing coming out of it. And then you, as they, you know, grow and grow and grow, they become the sleepers, which are like you have more of those tentacles sort of all pooling out, and then they're long tentacles with like almost like a flute-looking thing with like different eyes or whatever the instrument's called.
There's concept art. There's really cool concept art of like this big kind of like trunk creature with all these musical notes coming.
Yeah, but it's like a reverse, the sleepers. It's like the reverse enlightenment kind of thing, which is kind of on theme with the Sharmat, which is the idea that he dreams that he is real from the dream sleep. He's like awake in the dream. This is all very contrived and hard to get around, but it's basically that he's in the dream sleep dreaming himself into existence. He's like awake in the dream sleep, whereas usually it's the reverse. That might be,
in summary, we're going to have a sixth house podcast eventually.
Yeah,
that's
because like
perhaps
what's crazy about those guys is it like the Tribunal Gods and all the Battle of Red Mountain and Dagoth is that you can continuously change your understanding and think more and more and more about it and like different stuff. It's so
I like imagining the kind of the way these cultists essentially following Dagoth become. It's kind of like reminiscent of the actual. The story of, you know, you got the Heart of Lorcan, which is kind of the constant beat that's going on that Dagoth is, you know, very closely tied to. And, you know, obviously the tool, Khagranak's tools, including the hammer. What's the hammer
Sunder,
called again?
Sunder, Keening, and Wraithguard.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, kind of like the idea is tapping the heart of Lorcan to kind of sync yourself up with it, and then you've got these chimes and the bell hammers that these cultists are using, and you imagine they're all kind of syncing up, and the magic is flowing the same way the blight flows through Morrowind, you know, as like cleansing the land and all of this. It's very cool, but it gets very wacky.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I like that. Sounds good.
No, it's definitely mad. I don't know. You can touch as House Sadras, but there's basically nothing to say outside of it's mentioned that they replace House Lalu.
I think that could even be a Legends card. I feel like I've seen a Sadras agent, but I mean, you know, it's a Dunmer.
Yeah, it doesn't give you much.
It's a Dunmer looking agent with a blue sword. The sword is quite interesting.
Is it a bound sword or is it something else?
Maybe that's their art of a bound sword. Kind of looks like Chilrend with ethereal stuff around it. I don't know. But yeah, Sadras agent.
Also, I guess we should bring this up, and we've kind of brought it up a few other times in smaller parts, but how the sort of house politics interact. So the idea was in Khymer times, pre-tribunal, that, well, actually even a bit earlier, but basically the idea was that there was all these houses that were in all-out war all the time. Like, if you know, if House Redoran wasn't getting along with Indriel, they'll just go to war and so on. And that's where you get the unique function of the Morag Tong that gets implemented and so on, which is sort of adding this sort of third party to violently mediate all of the grievances between houses, and it actually leads to a greater stability of Morrowind, because they've got two things going for them. They've got three gods to tell them what to do, so they've got to behave, but then also it gives them a sort of like a catharsis or something, that I can get that person murdered because I don't like him or whatnot, you know?
Yeah, it's a weird dynamic when it's, you know, the Morag Tong not just being a kind of, oh, you know, there's more to them than just pay me and I kill this person. It's, you know, and you can imagine that that's kind of how it works. It's like, you know, the great houses are kind of allowed to operate freely. But then when, you know, certain individuals start pissing off too many people, like, you know, one branch of this big tree growing too crazy, then finally the Morag Tong will come in and chop it off and kind of bring back a little bit of order. But yeah, it's a weird balance.
It is a weird too. And I feel like it also like keeps them in more so like it creates a power balance by having this sort of powerful assassins third party that you can use to fight your opponents. It's like basically a weapon that everyone can use. So it's not like, oh, one has more military might, so they'll win or whatnot. And if you actually look into the fourth era, House Redoran, the one with a lot of military might and a lot of power, has sort of become the very dominant house of Morrowind and sort of leading, because there is no check and balance to Redoran's power anymore.
Mm.
So, you know, interesting reasoning for it. Don't know if I'd want to live in a society where the Morag Tong can show off my door and stab me, but... Yeah.
But anyway, I guess that brings us to the end, unless anyone has anything else to say. It's been a good podcast. Always nice to talk about Morrowind.
Yeah, people keep asking, one that like we'll get to it. There's a lot of we keep putting off because there's a few more like, not even simple, there's a few more like simply complex topics that we can talk about that aren't the ridiculous complexity of things like the 36 lessons of Vivec. People keep asking for us to break those down, but like it's just a lot. Like, it's almost like a video might be better to do that in, or like, I don't know, but it might be fun to do it like live and so on and like break it down.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I feel like it would be pretty fun. Like, as long as we have like a good period of kind of like beforehand study, and like, you know, going all into it and like getting well prepared.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd be down to go through them. I think it'd be
fun. And then we can do, you know, the Sharmat Six House kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Cool.
But yeah, all right. Anyways, thank you all for watching. And our social media links are in the description. And we look forward to nerding out with you all again very soon.